Hands come to order. We have members present, Representative Munoz. And I saw Representative Guttenberg, and he's here, Representative Costello, Stoltz, co-chair, Osterman, Representative, this is always my challenge, I don't know why, T. Wilson from North Pole, Badger. Representative Edgman and Representative Thompson. We have a quorum to do business, and what were we doing this morning? We have continuing presentation of the House of Senate Bill 49. We have Representative Newman, the vice chair, has also joined us. We have Representative Ledoux is here as the companion sponsorship and helped the sponsor present. I think we can probably just jump right in and invite Commissioner Struer and Mr. Barnhill to the table. And I think Mr. Barnhill was only for one section of the bill. We'll have them both up here. And you probably better remember your question specifically than I do, Representative Wilson. Welcome, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, different departments, though. Commissioner, just put yourselves on the record.
For the record, my name is Bill Struer, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services.
Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration.
I think your grasp by the committee is going to be much shorter, so we'll go ahead and start. I know we had at least one question, but who knows where we go from there, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question this morning was, since we're looking to better clarify what medically necessary means, can we not do the same thing for our state insurance so it's the same thing across the board?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's certainly within the legislative prerogative to clarify any definition that applies to the state of Alaska's health plan. Whether it makes prudent policy sense to do so in our context is probably a matter of debate. I'd be happy, though maybe reluctant, to engage in that with you right now. But if you want to have the discussion, certainly willing to do so.
Follow up, I do. And the reason I do is because I don't want to make this about classes of people. Who can afford what or who's on what kind of insurance? You know, and if it's about clarifying, which is what we heard this morning, then I guess I would like to know why we would not want to clarify it in Medicaid, which is basically a self-insured plan by the state, you know, with the federal government agreement. And then we are also self-insured as a state, although we may use Aetna to do that plan. So it's taken me a while to figure all this out. So it just seems to me that I can go back to my constituents and say, we do need better clarification, but we don't need it just in Medicaid, but the state too. And that way it doesn't matter whether or not the state's paying part of my share, which it does, as well as it pays the shares in Medicaid. So tell me why that doesn't make sense. Or if it does, that would be good.
Yeah. Why don't you elaborate on her question?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative. So I guess I'll start with focusing on the word need, and I suppose need is like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But let me just share some statistics which may or may not have been shared with the committee in the past. So in AlaskaCare, which up until January 1st was administered for purposes of reviewing abortion claims by HealthSmart/Wells Fargo from, I believe, 2010 to the end of 2013. In 2010, we had seven claims for induced abortions. Five were denied. One was originally approved, reviewed, and denied, refund requested and received. And then the seventh one was reviewed and found it should have been processed as a miscarriage, and that was corrected. So
if you want to restrict abortions, just turn it over to the insurance industry.
Mr. Chair, that's, I guess, a valid point. Most insurance plans, including our insurance plan, turn on whether the requested procedure is medically necessary. And we have a definition of medically necessary, and that's what's before the committee is making that term more concrete and explicit. The question is whether you would want to put that in our plan. The next statistic I was going to tell you is that, likewise, in 2011, there were various claims for abortion. All were denied. Now, when you're talking about elective abortion by our claims administrator, and so it probably is not going to come as a surprise to the committee that insurance plans, whether they're self-funded, as in the case of the state of Alaska, or fully funded, as in the case of many private employers, or fully insured, I should say, prefer not to pay for care that is not medically necessary. And there's, you know, aside from elective abortions, there's a huge spectrum of care of which the medical necessity is in question. Examples, over-the-counter medications where a person can just go and buy it for themselves without a doctor's prescription. Cosmetic surgery. And then there's a whole host of procedures that are prescribed that have absolutely no scientific basis whatsoever. We would prefer not to provide coverage for those. And so, therefore, we require this analysis of medical necessity, so we're not paying for things like ozone therapy and color therapy. I mean, what Aetna has done, they're our new third-party administrator as of January 1st, is they've compiled a fairly comprehensive list of things that they don't consider to be medically necessary so that we have a fairly firm basis as to what we're going to cover and what we're not going to cover. In the case of elective abortion, that is not specifically covered by the Aetna clinical policy bulletins, is what they call their library of information on what's medically necessary. But we do have this policy, and we've had this definition of medical necessity in place for quite some time that looks at a variety of factors. And one of those factors is the procedure primarily for the convenience of the patient. If it's primarily for the convenience of the patient, then that in and of itself suggests that it's not medically necessary. And so in addition to elective abortion, as I suggested, there are a whole spectrum. There's just dozens and dozens of procedures out there that don't rise to the standard, to the level of medical necessity. So I guess I would respectfully suggest to the committee, I think that the way our plan is currently being administered is appropriate. It's standard. I've checked with other insurance carriers just online, and the committee can do the same, or I can share the information that I found. But our definition of medical necessity is pretty much identical to other major carriers such as Cigna and Anthem, and it seems to be working just fine.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay. It's really nice because everything I heard from you is all making sense as it gets put together, because when I began the questions, I was asking medically necessary just to this one procedure versus the everything, as you just said, has to be medically necessary. You can't just go into the doctor and say, I want to do whatever it is. It's got to go through a process. So it seems like the process that the state has been using with the carriers that they have been working. As far as I know, they have never been sued, so obviously the courts must at this point be okay. I guess maybe that's a big assumption, since they could always sue. So I guess the other question, and I don't know whether it goes to you or to Commissioner Struer, so if we have something that's already working and it's going through a process, it sounds like it's a process that the state is happy with, then why don't we use that process that's working over here with Medicaid, which just really is just another type of insurance?
That's definitely a question for him.
I have a question for the, while we're on the insurance part of this. Pre-approval, is that kind of like a waiting period?
Mr. Chair, we have in place.
Is there any analogy to that? If it, because the insurance industry doesn't move with lightning speed. If you had to get and I think you know where the question is going, being an attorney as well as a deputy commissioner.
Not currently practicing attorney.
Well, you know, people are always running away from that, but please.
It actually saves us money.
Mr. Chair, we do have a list of procedures for which pre-certification is required under our plan with Aetna. Abortion is not one of those. But we, the list that we currently have is a list that was compiled by Aetna, and it was based on their view that certain procedures really do require pre-certification, either because the efficacy of that particular procedure may be questionable in a particular case, or that there is a need to ensure that folks know up front whether a procedure is going to be covered, or there may be some important concerns regarding transition of care. For instance, in dialysis, when someone is moving from inpatient status to an outpatient facility, caring for those transitions is quite important. Having the third-party administrator involved in those is important.
For an elective procedure, does it usually take, whether it's or the time of the elective, if gallbladder deciding to do a heart operation, does it usually take more than 24 hours to get approval?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay. Those are, I don't know, just thoughts. I didn't mean to jump in on you, did you?
Oh, no, I'm anxiously awaiting Commissioner Struer's
response. Commissioner Struer. Thank you for allowing me
to
interject there.
Representative T. Wilson through the chair.
I don't know how that was said, but go on.
Being old, I forgot the question because
I'll be more than happy to repeat it.
Since it
appears to me from the conversations that I have had that the state insurance, the process that they use when it comes medically necessary for any procedure, not necessarily this one, sounds like it's working. It's going through the process, and we're paying only for those that are medically necessary, not just in this procedure, but in other procedures, which I understand that Medicaid has medically necessary not just for this, but for all sorts of procedures. So if we have what appears to be working, and also at this point, and I'm not asking for a court case, it's not going through a court case, especially if other major carriers have utilized it, then why not use what's working versus coming up with this that we may be sued on and at the end of the day be right back where we were? So I'm trying to be consistent with all my heart to understand this.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'm not going to speak about the possibility of being sued for any of these procedures, but Medicaid is an entitlement program, and there's a perception that entitlement programs are first-dollar coverage for everything that is necessary, appropriate, or rendered. And in this case, we could do prior authorization. We could do retrospective review. We could do medical chart review. But in the interest of concerns of certain of the providers, I decided to, in the case of the form that we use with Medicaid, where the physician submits for payment, a checkoff box or checkoff page with boxes on it that say the medical procedures, which are very similar to the list that Senate Bill 49 has. As a kind of a more front end, in the case as Deputy Commissioner Barnhill presented, I believe 6 of 7 or 7 of 7 were denied. We could go through that process. It could be averted. We do a lot of prior authorization. We do a lot of retrospective review on procedures that could be elective rather than necessary. And we have similar success with some of them. And so it's something that we could do.
One more question, Mr. Chair. I don't want you to tell me whether they're going to be sued. I mean, the regulations are already going through a process. You know, somebody's already trying to do something there. So, I mean, I think that's already obvious. I guess it just seems at times where we can make things identical to something that's already working. You know, I guess I'm just really looking for a good reason, you know, why, you know, because they obviously have some kind of checkbox system as well. Maybe it has a, you know, prior authorization, which you don't currently do. But I guess what I'm really looking for is that it's a good reason why you would not use this process since it seems like it works versus something that at this point we don't know whether it works or not or whether or not it'll be challenged because those, like you said, are all maybes the other doesn't appear to be a maybe, and it gets us to the same point in the same place.
Representative Wilson, I believe that for most of the health care that is paid through Medicaid, we do use a similar process to what they use for the state employee plan in terms of the authorization, the review of the necessity of care. Where we run into difficulties with this particular procedure, a little bit of it is history in that we haven't been judicious in watching what was happening with this. The other part is that there's the fear of challenge, lawsuit, if you will. And moving forward, we're finding that that is an important concern. I don't know at this point that we could move to something as rigorous in the short term as what Deputy Commissioner Barnhill has described, but we could certainly take a look at that.
I'm really trying to process the difference between the two because I've been really consistent in my votes not saying that one group should have to do something, whether it has to do with any kind of procedures. And that's what we're kind of doing here, and that's why I'm really trying to understand, you know, besides we just don't want, you know, we might be challenged. I think we have a less chance of being challenged if we're being consistent and we're using one health insurance that we already know that there hasn't been challenges thus far with that we've had the last few years versus a new system in which the regulations have already been challenged, and so it wouldn't be a far stretch to think the other. And if ultimately we're trying to get that checkbox portion of it, I just need more explanation because it sure seems like the one works better than the other, and maybe I'm missing something.
It's very hard to quantify our risk of being sued. The capital budget has many items in there, which we have environmentalist groups and NGOs we know predictably will sue us to stop a road, a mining project that may or may be referenced in there. I know the Matsu Borough has probably lost $78 million in construction costs and added on costs by the Bob Shavelson Alaska Survival, cooking the keeper cabal. And that's, there's no remedy for that. You can't, litigation is a thing of life. We've got for us to not do something we think is good public policy because of the risk of a lawsuit is, I think we're overplaying that. We might as well not even pass a budget because somebody's going to sue us on something or other or how do we quantify a fiscal note. So I've been a little bit troubled by that aspect of this discussion.
But I guess my point is, Mr. Chair, is that if we know one plan currently isn't being challenged and it has worked not just for who we're with now, but with past carriers and big companies have already made it a practice, it just seems like the chances of it are much lower than going to something else that we already know that's been challenged. And at the end of the day, if we're just trying to make sure we're equal and we're checking the boxes, it just seems like we already have something that works. That's my only point.
It does sound like Aetna has a waiting period.
Well,
Mr. Trimmer, I think there's one important clarification here, and that would be that we're talking with Senate Bill 49, we're talking about Medicaid patients. So we're talking in terms of economic stratospheres, two different groups of people, those that are in the lower income strata and those that are essentially state employees who, for by and large, aren't in the low income strata, although there are some that clearly are. And so to me, I think that comparison bears weighting those groups differently as opposed to comparing them side by side as if you could have equal treatment. And I say that because this whole committee has functioned as a committee of a whole on the health social services budget, and we've gotten to visit in some excruciating detail, you know, what the impact is around the state, and particularly on those who are impoverished and don't have the opportunities, the economic opportunities, that maybe a normal state employee does. So to me, I mean, I think that I get where you're going with this, Representative Wilson, but on the other hand, I don't see a direct comparison because I think there are differences.
Representative Edgman, and I think Representative Wilson as well, through the chair, if I could. I think if you're talking about SB 49, you're talking about a definition. And a definition only. If you're talking about what Deputy Commissioner Barnhill has described, it's about a process in implementing that definition, and how they address it. How they confirm that they're following the definition? And you know, I'm not sure that this conversation is helping the with validity of SB 49 versus the process that we use to implement what SB 49 is proposing to do. I'm sure that they don't have published a definition for abortions in, I won't say I'm sure, I'm confident, I'm fairly confident that they don't have a definition that's published for abortion coverage in the state health plan, the state employee health plan, specific to abortion. And so I think laying the two side by side is a bit difficult for me to really follow.
Mr. Barnhill, I think we're going to cut you loose here.
That's great. remove the noose from my neck, but just to confirm, yes, abortion is not specifically defined in our plan booklet.
You sound more like a mortician than a lawyer. Or a deputy. Thank you, Mr. Barnhill.
I might call him back.
Yeah. Well, you can ask to call him back, Representative Guerra.
Sure.
You're free to leave. Representative Costello, and then Guerra.
Through the chair, my question was for Commissioner Struer, and he just left.
he was not given permission to leave.
Mr. Chairman, my apologies.
No, you don't. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Commissioner, could you walk through the process currently for Medicaid recipients who have an abortion? It's my understanding that the procedure's done and then the paperwork is submitted to the department for approval or reimbursement. Is that correct?
Representative Costello, through the chair, that is correct. What happens is we will sometimes travel the recipient to Anchorage or wherever the procedure is to be performed, frequently without knowing ahead of time whether it's for an abortion or whether it's for family planning counseling or other services through that particular provider. If an abortion is performed, then the provider submits a form, and there's two boxes on it. One of the boxes says it's Hyde Amendment, largely result of rape or incest, or it's not a Hyde Amendment and it's related to being medically necessary. All the boxes for the last 3 years have been related to medically necessary. All the abortions requested have been related to medical necessity. In 2012, I implemented strict use of the form, which was kind of not strictly complied with before, and all the abortions since that form began to be used were determined medically necessary, not related to Hyde. In 2013, I drafted the current form that is under court order to not be implemented at this time. And it includes 20-odd examples of potential medical necessity. So attempting to not define medical necessity, but asking the provider to submit to us the reason why they thought it was medically necessary to help us better understand and to hopefully get a better grasp of the necessity or the better grasp of the validity that it's medically necessary but not a Hyde. We have the highest rate of domestic violence, sexual assault in the nation, and the fact that we haven't had a single Hyde for several years is problematic to me. But the other part of that is to prevent us having to go out and physically look at the medical chart, retrospective review, sort of like Deputy Commissioner Barnhill was talking about. And that is a process.
A follow-up? What I'm trying to understand is whether or not this will change the course of events, that the way they're happening right now. So, for example, if the bill passed
Do you anticipate that women on Medicaid will be waiting to find out if they were approved, or will do you think that, or do we know from other states perhaps that the procedure's done and the payment issue is deferred, for a time in the future?
Representative Costello, through the chair, I don't know that the statute is going to significantly change the process. I believe that it will put some stricter rules and stricter parameters on abortions that can be paid for under this statute, but that the process itself won't change significantly. We will have to promulgate regulations to support the statute.
Through the chair. So it's your understanding that Medicaid recipients will be undergoing an abortion procedure and then the paperwork will be submitted. I mean, you don't see women actually waiting to find out if the procedure is reimbursed. And then also, could you tell us how much an abortion costs, how much that procedure costs?
Representative Costello, through the chair, unless I read the bill incorrectly, unless I'm going to be embarrassed, I do not believe that it requires that there be a waiting period prior to the abortion being performed. But it does distinctly define which abortions will be eligible for payment under that. The cost of an abortion, I want to say it's right at $600.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love to go a legislative term without arguing over abortion, but we're here. So I do have a question I think that I would ask for Mr. Barnhill to come to the table for, Mr. Chair.
He's here. That's your chance.
He ducked down. He was hiding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barnhill, how long were you an assistant attorney general?
Through the chair, 12 years, sir.
Thank you. There are a lot of times where we pass a bill where somebody may sue, they may not sue, we just don't know. But would you agree that the most likely case where somebody is going to sue is where you directly violate a Supreme Court order?
So you're both attorneys. Would you call that leading the witness?
I can rephrase that question in 100 ways. It's the same question. There's a Supreme Court order. It's defined what abortions are and are not allowed under state law. The state signed a consent decree in 2011. They defined medically necessary.
He's got the question.
So can is that not a very likely?
I'll give you a response, please.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I've had I've been an attorney now 21 years, and what I've routinely told clients is in Alaska, as pretty much anywhere, people can sue anytime about anything. And so you asked, is it likely? I mean, could it be likely? Yeah, it could be likely. But that's the nature of our system, is if someone has a complaint, they can bring it to a court of law in this state, in this country, and have it heard.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Barnhill, you don't think that it's very likely that by directly violating a Supreme Court order, there's going to be litigation?
I'm not going to. I need counsel to put in an objection to the nature of the question. I'm not going to testify on whether something's very likely or more likely or less likely. We're all, looking at some nebulous question in the future.
Thank you. And through the chair, the existing Supreme Court opinion, which resulted in a settlement between the state and the parties, defined medically necessary. I'm not going to go through the full definition. There's been discussion that there's no definition, but there is a definition. You would agree that the definition in this bill is different than the.
You put that in actual question.
Would you agree that the definition in this bill is different than the definition in the Supreme Court opinion and the settlement between the state and the parties?
Okay, this one's easy. I have never practiced in this area, but I believe there may be an attorney in this room that has, and so I will punt to the Department of Law with respect.
Fair enough.
Representative Guerra.
Do we ask that attorney later?
I don't know. I don't know if there's an attorney. Is Mr. Hutchinson the attorney or who?
I thought I.
You know what?
The attorney that I saw may be long gone.
She was lurking.
Okay, all yours.
Thank you, through the chair. The question is, do you agree that the bill that is before us?
Please, we have somebody here. I haven't met you before.
My name is Stacey Crayley. I'm a Chief Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law.
I guess we have seen you here before.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Crayley, would you agree that the bill that we have before us establishes a different standard than the Alaska Supreme Court standard that was adopted in the last Supreme Court opinion on this issue and the consent decree that followed?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm not before I answer the question and respond to your question, I'm not totally convinced I'm familiar with the consent decree that you're referring to, so can you provide me with that information?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The consent decree said that medically necessary shall be certified by a physician as medically necessary to ameliorate a condition harmful to the woman's physical or psychological health.
Why don't we wait until every member of the committee can actually see that, and I would like the sponsor to see it, and rather than seeing
I'm happy to distribute it, Mr. Chair. But it include it included a danger to a woman's physical and psychological health. The current bill leaves out psychological health, so. Are you able to determine whether the bill is narrower than the Supreme Court opinion?
At this point, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the Supreme Court did articulate a list of conditions that were testified to in the underlying Superior Court case that was subject to the appeal. And within that list, they did provide a reference to bipolar disorder. However, that list is not considered and has not been identified as a definition of medical necessity. And so I don't know whether or not I would be able to concede your point as you've crafted it. I still need to see the consent decree, because I do not believe that the consent decree that you're referring to relates to the 2001 Planned Parenthood decision. I believe it relates to the funding and the general relief medical program that was defunded in 1998, which actually led to this litigation. So the consent decree definition that I believe you're referring to, and again, I need to confirm that by looking at it, I do not believe is the definition that was at issue in the 2001 Planned Parenthood case, and to which Senator Coghill is attempting to provide a further definition of.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. And then, do you or Commissioner Struer, do you have an estimate of what the litigation in this case might cost? I've heard the term maybe $1 million or more.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I don't have an estimate of the cost of what it could or will be.
Through the chair, I'd like to go through just some facts on the Women's Health Program, just to get a better understanding from how that differs from what's in the law right now.
I don't understand. You're going to go through some facts, or are you going to ask some questions? Facts of really have a subjective understanding here.
Mr. Chair, I would like to gain an understanding of the difference between the Women's Health Program, which we deleted from this bill earlier today, and what exists in the law, so we can understand the difference.
Oh, we did already vote on that amendment.
Was that committee substitute?
Through the committee, which was substantially voting on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would like to have the information on the record for people on the House floor and for an amendment.
Okay, if don't be frustrated if they won't answer a question if you want, but please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, my understanding is that there are a few differences between coverage for family planning under the Women's Health Program, which is no longer in this bill, and then what we have in Medicaid. The first difference, I understand, is that...
Why don't you distill it to a question, Representative Guerra?
Am I correct in understanding that the Women's Health Program covers women, even if they are childless, whereas current Medicaid only extends family planning to women who have children.
And you don't have to certify his correctness or accuracy. You can just answer yes or no or elaborate. Since we're all dealing with lawyers and we're trying to build court records here, I think I want to give a lot of leniency to the folks that are answering questions, not to have them framed in a way that they don't feel comfortable answering or framed into an answer. I understand how this system works.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Garrett, through the chair, yes, it is different. But Medicaid recipient, these people are not currently eligible for Medicaid coverage, so they're not eligible for any of the Medicaid benefits.
Representative Garrett.
Through the chair. So currently, for family planning services, Medicaid does not cover women at a certain income level who have children? There's no family planning coverage under Medicaid currently?
Representative Dara, through the chair, just a liberal definition of those not eligible for Medicaid coverage under 100% of poverty level are childless adults. Most adults with children have some level of coverage within Medicaid and therefore would be eligible for family services.
Thank you. Through the chair, but for a pregnant woman who has no children, they are not covered but for family planning services under the current Medicaid system in Alaska. Is that correct?
That's incorrect. As soon as a woman becomes pregnant, she's eligible for an array of Medicaid services. She needs to apply, but she's eligible for an array of family planning services through
and,
Medicaid.
Please ask questions. Don't ask to validate statements.
Through the chair, are they the same family planning services that are available under the Women's Health Program?
I believe that, Representative Guerra, through the chair, I believe that they are.
Okay. And then what is the income limit under Medicaid that's available for family planning services right now, as opposed to the income limit that would make you eligible under the Women's Health Program?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that would be 100% FPL, federal poverty level, for under current Medicaid. I believe under the family planning amendment that it was proposed, that was, I believe, removed this morning, it's 175%. However, a childless, a woman who is pregnant may qualify, usually will qualify for Denali, or for, DKC, Denali Kid Care, and would be eligible up to 175% of poverty level. So pregnant individuals are covered.
Thank you, through the chair. And you're just to make sure. So the if you went through Denali Kid Care, what pregnant women would not be covered? You said most would.
Most Representative Garrett, through the chair. Most pregnant women at or below 175% of poverty level would be covered. Yeah. They would have to apply, however.
Through the chair, and which ones wouldn't be covered? You said most would be.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, there's exceptions to everything. I don't know what that would be, and I could try to find one of those for you, but I believe that most are covered.
Representative Garrett.
And then through the chair, would all be covered under the Women's Health Program, pregnant women who seek family planning services?
Representative Garrett, that is correct.
Okay. Then, through the chair, Denali Kid Care, my understanding is, covers at roughly 65-67% of federal funding, and would the family planning services under the Women's Health Program be covered at 90% of federal funding?
Representative Guerra, I believe that is correct as well.
For right now, Mr. Chair, those are the only questions I have.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, Commissioner, and I apologize if you covered this before I.
Do you need Ms. Crayley for anything?
I don't think so.
I know she's not comfortable there.
I know I have a lawyer, Mr. Chairman, but I'm not actually asking lawyer questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'd rather appreciate having legal aid up here.
Yeah, well, she can come back. I'm happy. Stacy can come back anytime. But, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering, Commissioner, if we have the bill in front of us, and then we have similar but not identical regulations that you had proposed. And I was wondering, I believe there's one, and I apologize, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the language in front of me. There's sort of one element that's different between the two. I was wondering if you could explain to us what that difference is and maybe a little bit about how it is that that was included in the regulation, since it's not in the bill in front of us.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, there are several differences in the regulation from the bill. I assume that the one that you're speaking to is the one regarding psychiatric.
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the language here.
That is correct.
Yes, I did put that in there. It was a hard decision, but as I read back, I wanted to get something in there that I could use, something that within the constraints of Medicaid that I thought would survive challenge, that we could, you know, continue to move forward on a meaningful program. And the language is a psychiatric disorder that places women in imminent danger of medical impairment. A major bodily function if an abortion is not performed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not entirely sure where I'm going with that. It's just there were some questions earlier this morning about the fact that the language in front of us doesn't include anything about mental health. And there was some discussion maybe about bringing the mental health trust folks in.
Or I believe they've spoken directly with Senator Coghill, and he's going to share some of those discussions. So
okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I just wanted to give the commissioner an opportunity to maybe address that. I'm not entirely sure.
I'm sure he was in on that conversation, actually.
Okay. And I guess I had one other question, Mr. Chairman, following up on a question I had this morning about because I honestly don't know the answer, sort of the non-viable fetus situation, which we were told this morning doesn't occur very often. Very glad it doesn't. But in the event, under this bill, or I guess under your regulations, too, I'm curious, if you did have a situation where the fetus wasn't viable, I'm trying to figure out whether that would be something that could be covered under the language in front of us.
Representative Holmes, for the chair.
And you can call it baby if you want. No, it's a personal thing.
Yeah, no, I mean
I understand. I'm not to be combative.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, these are bad situations, generally speaking. I mean, they're generally speaking, we're talking about, you know, children who are wanted, who, you know, you're in the second or third trimester, or these are, you know, really heartbreaking situations. But if you are in a situation like that, I just wanted to make sure that is something that could somehow be covered, a procedure that could be covered.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, I won't say this for certainty at this point. I have to look into it further, but I believe that it is covered, and that we have covered it in the past.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if we could follow up on that. Those are really heartbreaking situations generally, and I wouldn't want to add to.
We want to make sure we give this. We left this part of it open because I know there'd be lots of questions, and it's not an easy subject for a lot of folks. Representative Munoz, and then Edgman, and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Commissioner. Could you tell me if there are abortions that are not funded because they were rejected for purposes of medical, that they were not medically necessary? Are there any examples in Alaska recently that you're aware of where doctors are rejecting these procedures for those reasons?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I'm confident that there are abortion procedures that are delivered that aren't paid for by insurance. I do not believe I have any knowledge that we have denied in Medicaid any abortions in this last calendar year.
Okay, so just for clarification then, all medically funded abortions have gone forward and have been approved regardless of the medical necessity definition?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, that's not correct.
That's not correct.
If because of the form that we have, that we are currently using now, not the redesigned form with the 20-odd clarifications on it, that form has to be submitted for payment to be received, and it has to be certified by the physician administering the abortion that it was medically necessary, but without detail. So they are certified abortions.
Okay, but if I may, you're not aware of any that are being rejected that have made the attempt, you know, through a doctor to get the abortion services, but for, judgment calls on the part of the physician, they're being rejected.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, if a request for payment for an abortion is submitted without the form with the certification, it will not be paid for. However, to my knowledge, we have not received any of those forms in the last year, or any of those requests in the last year. All have been accompanied by a form.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munoz. Representative Edgeworth.
Mr. Chairman, is this our one opportunity to question the commissioner? Because I did have a couple additional questions.
He's going to be here as long as you guys want to.
Okay.
Waterboarding.
I've got some talking points here in front of me, and I want to lay them out and have you either refute them or tell me if you agree with them. And it says here, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which collects state-by-state data on reproductive.
And you're going to describe the source?
I don't have a source here. They were on my desk, and as mysterious as that sounds, that is where they came from. And I think you can unattributed talking points unless corroborated by the top.
Make sure that these are not from the London School of Medicine, or these aren't from
the New England School of Medicine. But anyway, I'll paraphrase if that might be more appropriate. So basically, more than 50% of the pregnancies in Alaska are unwanted pregnancies, and huge costs attributed to that, throughout time, and a lot of costs that are absorbed by state agencies. The number here is over $20 million. And of those more than 50% of unwanted pregnancies, the majority of those are unintended pregnancies that, according to what this claims, could have been essentially prevented if we had more family planning services in place. That's a pretty ambiguous laying out of these points. But I guess my first question would be is, do you know enough to corroborate those or to say those are fairly accurate in terms of their assumptions? And then I have a follow-up question I'd like to ask after you respond, if I may, through the chair.
No, can you, the unsighted source, you can feel free to comment on that.
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, I'm familiar with Guttmacher, and I have read that. But as you read it as well, there's several assumptions made through that document, and I can't corroborate or deny those numbers, and it's done by a think tank. I think Guttmacher's out of the East Coast somewhere. It's a large research institute, and I don't know whether they use national averages on that. I don't know whether they go state by state. I can't give any validity to it or argue against it. So,
well, the question I'm trying to get to here ultimately is whether more family planning services could head off those unwanted pregnancies, and along the way, as this committee has discussed at such great length over the last year and a half, it seems, can we actually save the state money? Can there be an economic benefit to having more family planning services in Alaska? And I ask that generally, maybe you disagree with that, and that's what I would like to hear if that is the case.
And that just sort of begs the question, what does family planning often encompass? And I think the sponsor might have some.
Okay, and I think that'd be fair enough, Mr. Chairman, to
And actually, why don't we have the sponsor come up on this, because this is very subjective matter, and sponsors. As I think it's unfair to just have the commissioner be as it. Speak on the. Let's have the sponsors answer that question, if you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the question, and also with me as the representative who may also wish to comment. First of all, the Guttmacher Institute is probably credible, definitely a pro-abortion group, and they have definitely with whatever tools they had tried to ascertain that. So, but we don't know in Alaska. So to claim that 50% of the pregnancies in Alaska would be unwanted, I find incredible. To claim that 50% of those are unintended, to me would be also incredible. But to ask if we should do family planning services beyond what we already do, you know, it really does beg the question, probably generally, are our families deeply involved the way they should be? Is the government the only one that can ever counsel people? And would the Planned Parenthood be the place where you'd want to send them for family planning services, seeing how their main goal is both family planning for contraception and abortion, which to me heads off in the direction of population control rather than on family planning. So you asked for an opinion. That's an opinion that I would have. I can tell you that on the legal end of it, Planned Parenthood has been the aggressive litigant in every abortion case in Alaska, proposing that abortion is always performed with the lowest possible threshold to entrance. And I understand that their goal is to protect women's right to choose. And I understand where they're coming from, and I agree with the women's right to choose, but I also tend to agree that the right then doesn't necessarily have to fall on somebody else to pay for it. And so for that, when it's totally elective, this convenience issue, then I think that a responsibility falls upon the woman. We've also agreed, though, that prior to that responsibility, we will, as a state, put out money, probably to a significant tune, for preventive service, education in schools, and places that in nonprofits, including Planned Parenthood, can give some counsel, whether it's contraception and other research issues. So I guess I'd call the stats into question for Alaska, and am willing to work with people, because I agree with you that if unplanned or unintended consequences, pregnancies, I'm sorry, are going to be the issue, I would do whatever I could to encourage people to make wise choices. There are times when they don't have that opportunity, and I fully will appreciate that, and have been a fierce defender of those who have been so misused. And so I find, though, that if it's convenience, then it should be a responsibility to bear.
Representative Ledoux.
I'm just going to go off on a little bit different track here. I think we're talking apples and oranges. We're trying to get a bill which simply defines what is medically necessary for an abortion. Now, all of this discussion about family planning services, we've got 60 days left in this session, and here is the entire House Finance Committee. If it's the will of the legislature, if it's the will of the Finance Committee to increase funding for Medicaid, to increase funding for family services, then let's talk about this in the Health and Human Services budget. There's no need to Christmas tree this particular bill, which is a simple bill with discussions of family planning services.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may, my perspective is economics here. Can we save the state money by reducing unwanted pregnancies through additional services to women who otherwise would not have access to them? That's my question. And with the greatest respect to both of your convictions on the subject, because I know you are very, Senator Coghill, use your term, fierce defenders, I still don't see that correlation that would suggest that connection doesn't agree with the premise.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
That's going to go to you for cleanup here, but I think it was more appropriate on the subjectivity of this to go to the sponsors. But please.
I want to speak to the family planning for just a second and talk about that. When I was responding to Representative Guerra's question, I was responding to family planning within the context of Medicaid and Denali Kid Care. We do family planning services, the 90-10 money, through most of our public health centers. Those services are available. They're open to any woman who presents for those services. The 90-10 money is available for three areas. Diagnosis of general reproductive health conditions, the diagnosis of sexual transmitted diseases and infections, and contraception. All the other family planning services are 50-50. So that's a point I need to clarify, because everybody talks about the 90-10, but that's a rather narrow scope of covered services under that. The public health centers, our public health staff, provide those services. You know, we've distributed, I don't want to say how many condoms, over the years for a variety of people. I know I should have a better word for that, Mr. Chairman, but I don't. And it costs a full range of family planning services under the 90-10 and the 50-50 money. The family planning program is about $800 per recipient. And that's a full range of services available to them. If we expand the family program, family planning services to the full population under 175% of poverty level, that's 14,000 additional women that need to be covered under that. So you can do the math. It's substantial. But we do reach out. We do make those services available, and we will continue to make those services available without having a formal program added at this time.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr.
No, that's what we're trying to provide here. Is the sponsors, would you like to stay up here, or would you like to go back to the cheap seats? No, I'd be, okay, that's sort of answering the question. Whether they like to or not, I guess they're going to stay here. Representative Guttenberg first.
So, Mr. Commissioner, were you involved in making this list? The list that's in the bill.
We're involved in what? I'm sorry.
Creating the list of acceptable reasons for an abortion.
No, sir, I was not.
Okay. Is there any other medical procedure that is delineated for like this in the Medicaid for? Open heart surgery, for cancer treatment, for anything else? Is this the only place that we have, you have, you know, there's all these subcategories that are in here? Are you aware of any?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, most medical procedures that we use either prior authorization or retrospective review for, we use specific procedure or specific criteria that we look at. So, yes, it is. It's not published in this manner.
So there's nothing else in statute that's delineated like this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg, I can't speak to statute. I can only speak to regulation. And regulation, we do have limited scope in that, yes.
So, if I may, the sponsor.
Just to answer that, Mr. Chairman, probably since Roe versus Wade, there's probably been no other area of health issues that has been litigated so intensely. So. There's a column that goes all the way down to how this is done by way of procedure. So even this definition, as you said, lined out in there, Representative Guttenberg, really emanated from everywhere from a consent decree through a Supreme Court case. And in listening to the various issues they brought out, we even agreed that the doctor should have the kind of final say, so we tried to put language in there to protect the life of the mother to the extent possible. And so it really emanated from a whole list of litigation.
If I can follow up.
Gettenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Geez.
Thank you.
Usually it's a compliment for me.
Representative Dew probably knows, but Senator, do you know what Tay-Sachs is?
No, sir.
Okay. It is in this dictionary. Hereditary disorder caused by the absence of an enzyme needed to break down fatty material marked by yak, 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 causing death in childhood. It's a Jewish hereditary disease. And I'm just wondering why it was left off.
My understanding that it may cause death, but it's the death of the child, that less related to the death of the mother. Tay-Sachs does not cause the death of the pregnant woman.
And if I may, and how is that different from sickle cell?
The health of the mother, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll get into that later. Thank you.
We need to bring our home Reader's Digest guide on medical stuff just to keep up with this. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I share some of Representative Edgman's concerns that I think really where I'd like to see the state putting a lot of its effort is how do we avoid the situation of unwanted pregnancies in the first place. I think that's where we're going to do the most good, and I think where most people in this building can come together. So I'm hoping we can all keep working on that. But I just really, Mr. Chairman, raised my hand because I'd like to make what I think will be a friendly amendment to what Senator Coghill was saying when he was talking about family planning services, and he was talking about sort of elective family planning services. I believe he said it's the responsibility of the woman. And Mr. Chairman, what I hope the senator meant to say, it is the responsibility of the woman and the man to engage.
I think he clearly meant to say that. It was an incredible oversight on his part.
I'm sure that Senator Coghill really meant to say it is the responsibility of the woman and the man.
Will be duly corrected.
Thank you.
I think I see a level of contrition there, Representative Holmes.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson and then Guerra.
And I'm sorry if I missed it, but I just want to go back to Representative Costello's questions just about the process. Okay, so the way I understood the commissioner was that if a woman goes in to see her doctor to even, you know, see about an abortion, then the doctor would have some type of conversation just for any kind of procedure. I guess my question is a determination made then, because the way I understood it, it was like he checks one of the box, would check one of these boxes, the procedure would be done, the paperwork would go to you. Is that correct? Or am I missing a step somewhere?
Representative Wilson, through the chair.
I want to ask all members not to certify your level of correctness or certainty, just for the record.
Yeah. So could you tell me what the process is?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the process is, the first part of it, you were correct. The procedure is performed, and then when the provider submits the bill for the services, they submit the form, completed out, attesting to the medical necessity for the procedure. If they don't submit the form, they're not paid for the procedure.
Okay, follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
And this is where I'm confused then. Okay, so the procedure has already been done. The doctor submits the form. Then if it wasn't medically necessary, although they checked a box, whose responsibility would that be to make the determination at that point? Because the procedure's already been done. The bill is now just awaiting to be filled. So I'm just trying to figure out how it's different from what we're doing now to this process, from what you're describing.
Either the sponsors or the commissioner.
Well, it's really the commissioner, because commissioner's Medicaid's the one who's going to make the determination on whether it's paid for.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, whether there's a form or not, determination of medical necessity, review for medical necessity can be conducted at any time. The touch point, the telling point as to whether or not the state agrees to pay for it is at the either at the point of the form or in the case of questioning the form, the medical review of the chart. We can go in and look at a medical chart at any point in time. So I don't know what I'm missing.
Through the chair. The way I'm understanding it, I don't know how else to post this, so I'm not trying to break your rules, seriously. Because really, it's not as simple as representative, for me it's not, as the representative said, because it's not just about the definition. Because if it was about just the definition, it would be a medically necessary definition no matter what the procedure was. But we're making it about a certain procedure. Okay, so one of the things that we're hearing is that we are making choices for women. But the way I'm understanding the procedure being is that we are going to provide it, unless maybe at the doctor's level, so the doctor has a conversation, the doctor says, I'm sorry, I can't check one of the boxes, then he sends the woman away. Is that the first step?
Representative Wilson, I believe that the doctor makes that decision as to one of three things. He or she can perform the abortion. And submit the form. He or she can perform the abortion and not submit the form and provide other means of payment for the procedure or talk to the woman about the necessity and the desire for the abortion and is she wanting to go forward with it.
Okay, follow up. Okay, so let's say that it wasn't medically necessary from the doctor, and so the doctor turns the woman away, okay. Do you know, because, and this may be from the sponsors, in our packet was a form that looked like this that talked about payment types, cash, insurance, Medicaid, multiple payment, other not stated. I always like those others. So I'm turned away. I don't have the money to do anything. But I'm going to go out there and look for the service. Is the other not stated category, is that maybe some type of service through Planned Parenthood in which they are providing the abortion service and they're using some other type of funding to do it? Because that's the question to me. What happens to the woman who still is going to go ahead and get the abortion, whether or not Medicaid pays it or not? Is there another place for them to go if they don't have the money? Or are we really talking about the olden days where they had to go into a back alley and have it done? Do you know if there's some other process, a nonprofit or something that does that?
Representative Wilson, I'm not going to speak for the providers out there, particularly Planned Parenthood, but I believe that there are other sources. I think that you like with any medical procedure that's denied, you bear the risk of them going to a cut rate place to get it done, whatever it may be. And I've heard about it for all kinds of elective medical procedures that they go and they find somebody that advertises, and it's a better deal. So I can't speak to, you know, what they will do, but I can only speak to what Medicaid does and what Medicaid pays for and what it takes to get Medicaid payment.
So I guess my question is to you, Mr. Chair. So the Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics is who puts out this form. It would be interesting to know if they know what other not stated, because in 2012, that's 766 abortions that fall in this category for 2012. And so I don't know whether it's just like another other, because in 2013, it goes down to 248, which is an extreme drop. And the cash payments go from 154 in 2012 up to 538 in cash. So if other and not stated means that there is another place for a woman to go, then really what ends up happening here with this bill, and just in my little world, is that we're not telling women whether they can or cannot have an abortion. We're just saying that if it doesn't pay it under Medicaid, then if we can find out what other not stated means, there is somewhere else to go. It just comes down to whether it's the state or whoever this other not stated category is. And then I know that they're going to be taken care of, and that's what I'm trying to get clear in my mind.
Representative Wilson,
the question was, I believe, to me, but I'm going to defer it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chairman, go for it. No. Representative Wilson, through the chair, let me go to vital statistics and find out exactly what those mean and get the definitions for the committee and get those back to you.
Thank you, because that to me that makes a huge difference. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll do better on my questions next time.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you may not believe this, but none of us are family planners. We're just playing them on TV right now. And I realize I made a mistake before. I didn't understand something. So I think there's a goal among many, if not all of us, to limit the number of unwanted pregnancies and abortions. And oddly enough, we could probably get pretty close to each other and just not fully agree on everything. I'm trying to understand the difference of coverage under Denali Kid Care and the Women's Health Program. And I had a misunderstanding before, so I didn't ask the right questions. But leaving public health clinics aside, let's assume that a woman should have a right to go to the medical provider of their choice.
Choose your own doctor type of plan?
So I like that.
Yeah, I like that too if it worked.
So forget about public health clinics. You want to go to the provider of your choice. Under Denali Kid Care, if you're pregnant, you're covered up to 175% of the poverty level, right? And you can get family planning of certain kinds up to that level. You explained that to me. But the category of family planning I missed, which is probably the most important form of family planning, is if you're not pregnant yet and if you're trying to avoid a pregnancy. Under Denali Kid Care, if you're an adult and you're not pregnant and you have no child, you're not eligible for Denali Kid Care. Is that correct?
To the chair, that's correct.
So if you sought family planning through the provider of your choice through Denali Kid Care, not pregnant, no child, you're an adult, you can't get it under Denali Kid Care. That's correct.
That's correct.
Under the Women's Health Program, however, if you have no child and you're not pregnant and you're trying to get contraceptive or other family planning services, you would be eligible. Is that correct?
Would you be eligible? Is that the question?
Commissioner, under the Women's Health Program, if you're not pregnant, you have no child, and you're an adult, and you want to get contraceptive services so you don't have an unwanted pregnancy, you'd be eligible for family planning services under the Women's Health Program. Is that correct?
It's brief and easy. Let's ask questions. Please don't. Your question.
If you're not pregnant and you're not on Medicaid, you would not be eligible for family planning services under Medicaid, but you would be available through a public health center.
Okay. And through the chair. But what about the Women's Health Program? So you earn less than 175% of the poverty level. You're not pregnant. You're an adult. And you would like to get contraceptive services or other family planning. Wouldn't you be eligible for the Women's Health Family Planning Services under Medicaid in that circumstance?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, only if you expand the Women's Family Planning Program. Like a Medicaid expansion, we go to 138% of poverty level. People are eligible for the full array of benefits. It's an expansion, no matter how you cut it. So, yes, it would be available.
So, and through the chair, so if we apply to the federal government for what we're eligible for under the Affordable Care Act, which is coverage up to 175% of the poverty level, then a woman who is not pregnant, who is an adult who has no children, could get contraceptive services under the Women's Health Program, but could not get them under Denali Kid Care. Is that correct?
Jeez, I forgot. I just had a conversation a minute ago with the person. Would you wait for him to rephrase the question? not that hard to ask questions.
Mr. Chair, it is hard to ask questions in a way that somebody else is asking you to ask them. I can ask them in the way that I'm able to ask them.
To not just make the statement and ask him to validate it, ask the question.
I will honor your request, Mr. Chair.
I don't think it's an unreasonable one, given that, given the complexity of many of these things. I don't think it's fair to have somebody to allow a long statement to be made and then be asked to validate it. When it's, please ask your question.
Except for when it's accurate, Mr. Chair.
Well, see, that's the problem. You have a certitude, and you're expecting everybody else to endorse that, and that is the problem with a fair committee process. I'm not trying to be argumentative, but I see a method and a means, and I think it's very simple if you would just ask the question. I don't think that's an unreasonable request, and if you want to make it difficult, I guess we'll be here longer, but it's our goal to try to get through this very difficult subject in the most civil way possible.
Ms. Commissioner, I'm trying to be as civil as possible, so let me ask this question in a way that won't draw an objection. If we applied to obtain the women's health coverage program up to 175% of the poverty level, as is allowed under the Affordable Care Act, would we be able to obtain family planning services, including contraception, for women, even if they're not pregnant, even if they earn up to 175% of the poverty level?
Yes. Through the chair.
And through the chair, that's a major difference between that and the coverage that's not available under Denali KidCare. Is that correct?
There we go.
Representative Guerra, I'm sure.
Let me try that again. Correct me if my understanding is incorrect.
I almost give up. Go ahead.
We would have been done with this like 10 minutes ago, Mr. Chair.
If you hadn't been obstinate, yes, I understand. But please go.
Or if I were allowed to ask my questions the way I'm able to. Those services that are available under the Women's Health Program for contraception to non-pregnant adults, those are not available under Denali KidCare if you're not pregnant and you're an adult, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
We have own rules for different people, I guess. So, any other questions?
I have one question.
Representative Munoz.
On that Medicaid topic again, you said earlier, I believe you said that the 90-10 split was only available for three categories of service. Could you go over that one more time, please? And is that group of women or eligible population of individuals, the 12,000 or 14,000 individuals, would they also be eligible for other service at the 50-50 split? I think I heard you say that. Would you please explain that further?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, the three categories, once again, are the diagnosis of general reproductive health conditions, diagnosis of sexually transmitted infections, STDs, and contraception. Family planning-related services, such as the treatment of the conditions diagnosed, receive the normal federal participation rate of 50%, even if treated in family planning clinics. So, for example, an individual could have routine testing and diagnosis of an STD and get 90% on that, while the actual medication would be reimbursed at 50%. So it is a part of the package. It's at a reduced reimbursement level.
Okay, so if I may follow up. On the fiscal note that you put together for that particular part of the previous legislation, I think we're going to take it up again, perhaps, but did your fiscal note include the 50-50 cost to the state that would not be reimbursed at the 90-10 rate?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, that was so long ago I don't remember, so I'm going to have to get you that answer.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for the panel there? Did you have any interjections for sponsors?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, thank you for taking the day to take this issue up. I know that getting to a definition in this very narrowly crafted law is tough. I can appreciate that. Under Medicaid, we have a an agreement with the federal government that we will take care of people under certain economic conditions. And so within that, though, we do on almost every other area have a process to define what is necessary. This pretty narrow piece of legislation and law is highly litigated, and it requires probably this kind of tension that you're not going to get in almost any other area to define what is medically necessary. Coming out of this, also, all the peripheral issues of the both philosophy and practice, as you see. So with this, what we tried very hard to do was to say there are those that really are for the health and life of the mother. And I think we're going to come into a day in our society where we really have to start asking ourselves, can we afford to provide everything to everybody, or do we have to ask, is it really needed? And I think in this particular case, this is one of the tougher ones. I appreciate that. I thought we tried to take the Supreme Court case and answer it from the legal perspective and from the medical perspective, and therefore we came up with the best we knew how under the kind of the narrow conditions that are really demanded of us. So the Supreme Court spoke, and I'm trying to answer within that frame, and I think whether we could do it in any other healthcare industry, I think, is debatable. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I know the committee members have put a lot of thought into it. I greatly appreciate it. I've tried to be as deliberate as I can, and I know that it's tense, but you heard from doctors, you heard from lawyers, you heard from advocates, and hopefully you'll pass this bill out, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I don't really have that much substantive to add other than to thank the committee. And also to comment, there seems to be some suggestions throughout the questioning here that there's something awful about the public health clinics, that you wouldn't want to go to a public health clinic that provides all of these family planning services. Instead, you'd want to go to someplace else. Well, I can say that during all of the time that I lived in Kodiak, and Representative Osterman's probably familiar with the public health clinic there, I went to the public health clinic for all sorts of services, and I thought they did a fine job. And if the health clinics around the state are at all equivalent to the one that exists in Kodiak, I can't see why anybody wouldn't want to go to them.
As much as I would like to dispense with one way or another with this subject today, I think the roundtable of final discussion and discussion of the amendment would consume more time than we have. And this is a topic that certainly warrants deliberation. I don't want to rush anybody. Certainly, there's a lot of upside to taking care of it today, but I don't think the upside is the public process. So. Appreciate the members putting the bulk of their day into this subject matter, and we have an amendment before us. I could perhaps rule it dilatory because we really voted on it. It's the same substance of the CS, but we have a very open process in this committee, so we will have an opportunity to vote on it again. But I do believe it certainly is potentially dilatory, given that we've already voted on it in the exact same substance. But this is a process committee, and so we will bring that back and forward. The sponsors will be back to give their comments on the proposed amendment. We'll have a discussion of the this is the finance committee. I imagine we'll have some wandering discussion of what the fiscal note is. I think it's accurately expressed to us that will be a subject to debate. I think you've heard the questions, both the sponsors. You know which members might have need some follow-up attention, and I'll leave that to you. And Commissioner Struer is probably anxious to talk to any of you individually. He's not, but he's willing to. So with that, I thank everybody for their participation. Very good comments that were put on the record. That's part of this process. Everybody's acknowledged that they're going to litigate it, or it will be litigated, and that is one of the reasons I have I've had a little bit of caution to make sure they are questions, and it's really unfair for people who might be part of a future party to be asked to endorse fairly long statements, and that's an unfairness to the witnesses. I think it's unfair in any way to make a broad long statement and then say, "Am I right?" or validate me, and that's really unfair. I encourage everybody to watch an episode of Jeopardy in the form of a question. And with that, we will stand in adjournment. Tomorrow's schedule, we have House Bill 298, which is confidentially of performance reviews. That's a follow-up to House Bill 30, which was passed in the 2012 session, I believe. We have, or 2013, excuse me, there were some problems in 2012. House Bill 234, extend the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. We'll have some of the commissioners here on that. And House Bill 268, this is the one I've been looking for and waiting for, Big Bull Moose Derbies. So with that, we will stand adjournment. Thank you, everybody, for your patience in this process.